This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Pleasure to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
At the Trumpet, we focus on four major geopolitical regions, each of which is prophesied to have a specific trajectory in this end time. The King of the South is a radical Islamic force led by Iran. The King of the North is a European empire led by Germany. The Kings of the East is an Asian alliance led by Russia and China. And Anglo-America is prophesied to fall after a temporary resurgence. Our first three stories show how a rise in militarization by each of those first three powers is happening right before our eyes. We're going to start with the King of the South. We're seeing continued escalation of tensions with Iran. This time it's Britain that is the main protagonist. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, this is very interesting to have Britain on the receiving end of Iran's antagonism. That's what we saw this week. Of course, it was in response to what took place last Thursday. If I just talk about that briefly to recap, there was a tanker belonging to Iran that was heading towards Syria, and that it was traveling through the Straits of Gibraltar. And Britain, with some of its Royal Navy members, impounded that vessel, seized it as it came through there because it wanted to uphold European Union sanctions on Syria. It's illegal, according to the European Union, to sell oil to Syria. And since they knew that this Iranian tanker, loaded with 2 million barrels of oil, was headed there, they've impounded it, and it still sits there to this day off the coast of Gibraltar. Actually, today they arrested the captain and another member of the crew as well for breaking those sanctions. So in response to that, the Iranians said that they were going to try and take or do the same thing to a UK tanker in the Persian Gulf, because obviously these tankers belong to BP and other British companies. They have to transit the Strait of Hormuz, which is another one of these gateways like the Straits of Gibraltar. And Iran's coast is right alongside that, the northern side of the Strait of Hormuz. And at the time, this week we had two British tankers that were due to transit that on Wednesday, the Strait of Hormuz, and you had one of them made its way through. It was flanked by the HMS Montrose, a British frigate. And then the frigate came back to get the second, the British Heritage, and move that one through the Straits of Hormuz and would fight off any Iranian threat if there was one. And sure enough, there was. There were three fast Iranian fast boats that tried to pull the tanker British Heritage into Iranian waters. The Montrose targeted them with their guns and basically said, "Back off or we'll fire," and the Iranians did so.
So this is a really fascinating story. You've got two elements here. One that we've seen quite a lot of, and that is this kind of aggressive, pushy moves by Iran. This is definitely right in the same vein as that. Maybe we can focus on that first. But then there's also this aspect, what we have not seen so much is a very strong response from Britain. That's a bit unexpected. We could talk about that in a little bit. But maybe you could just talk about Iran first.
Yeah, well, Iran, it's really interesting because Iran said that they were going to do this, and then they tried to do it. And of course, Iran understood that they could see the British frigate that was right beside this tanker, and yet they still tried to take it to see what would happen, to see if Britain would back down. Of course, we've got over the past month all these increased acts that Iran has perpetrated against oil tankers just on the outside of the Strait of Hormuz as well. The tankers that were hit by mines and such, that was only a couple of weeks ago. And so Iran is trying to show the world that it believes itself as responsible for everything that comes in the Persian Gulf or out of the Persian Gulf. I mean, we call it the Persian Gulf, right? The Persia is ancient Iran. And so they are trying to leverage their power over that sea gate. And they're not, they are somebody that is willing to throw a bit of weight around.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Britain. We've talked quite a bit about the resurgence within the United States under Donald Trump, prophesied as an end-time Jeroboam, like our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has discussed. Is this kind of what we're seeing from Britain as well?
Well, point one, it would be very unlikely that Britain is going to act by itself against Iran. They wouldn't have impounded the huge tanker. Remember, Iran's suffering for money right now. They need all their oil that's going to a seller to actually reach there. And so Britain wouldn't have done this knowing that Iran would have a response up its sleeve if America wasn't already a very strong ally towards this purpose. But nevertheless, it took a lot of guts. It took a lot of guts to start enforcing something that had been in place for 9 years and was not being enforced. Iran was shipping oil to Syria for years and nobody was doing anything. And yet here we have Britain one day waking up. There's an Iranian tanker. We're going to enforce these rules. And we're sending in our Marines, sending a helicopter. And just today they announced that they're sending the frigates coming out of the Persian Gulf. We're sending a destroyer now to the Persian Gulf. And so this is just following in line of what America has been, Mr. Trump has been trying to push the world to see, that Iran is a dangerous actor and we all need to band together at stopping it from controlling the Middle East, be it through their nuclear program or otherwise. But yeah, this is really something else to behold, that Britain's doing this. I mean, if you go back to the early 2000s, you had in three separate occasions Royal Navy soldiers being taken by Iranians in the Persian Gulf, being held captive for a few days and then humiliated, basically. And the British Navy allowed it to happen, and now they're not allowing it to happen. And so, yeah, it is. It's very interesting to see that America here, it looks like, has an ally in its fight against, or in its at least high pressure campaign, as it's calling, against Iran. And who is that ally? It's long lost friend, Britain. And as we go into an article on the Trumpet, we talk about how Britain is. Has a brotherly relationship and a longstanding brotherly relationship with the United States.
That article Brent wrote on thetrumpet.com yesterday, it was published, the United Kingdom stiffens its spine against Iran. One more thing before we move on, the United States response to what happened this week. Just talk briefly about that.
Loved it. I love the British response, of course. They're not the only one that is coming on hard against Iran, it seems. They're also trying to strike together an international group of nations that is going to police the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab al-Mandab on the other side of the Persian Gulf, because they know that Iran's strategy, as we've been saying for five or six years now, that Iran wants to control these seaways. The United States sees that, and so they're bringing together a number of nations to bring their naval forces into the area to stop Iran from controlling it.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you for that, Brent. Now over to the King of the North. Germany has positioned itself as a major arms exporter, and its share in this global market continues to grow. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany had a very significant jump in the arms exports that it approved during the first half of this year. So for all of last year, the entirety of 2018, it approved about 5 billion euros worth of arms exports. For the first 6 months of 2019, it approved 5.5 billion. So already we've surpassed 2018's total. Now, one of the remarkable things about this is Germany's in this left-right coalition. The left wing of that coalition, the Social Democratic Party, don't like arms exports, and especially don't like arms exports to the Middle East. And they've been talking a lot about stopping this, talking a lot about slowing this down. They've worked quite hard to slow it down in recent years. Despite all that, you've had this massive jump in Germany's arms exports for the first 6 months. So there's some strong determination within Germany to keep this going, despite quite heavy opposition to it.
What's driving the increase?
Hungary. part of it. They were the largest. And then also the Middle East. Egypt was number two on the list. The United Arab Emirates was number six on the list. And one thing that I think is especially interesting about the United Arab Emirates is, you know, they're involved in kind of all sorts of conflicts in the Middle East, and they're bringing German weapons into them. So German Foreign Policy, for example, had an article earlier in this week, and they were talking about how German weapons have started showing up in Libya. Haftar, the general there that's been leading this attack on Tripoli, he has been using German weapons, and they've also been showing up in Yemen. Now, these are areas that are under UN arms exports bans. It's illegal for Germany to sell weapons, say, directly to someone like General Haftar into Libya. They've been getting there via the United Arab Emirates. And there's been a long-term close relationship between the German military and the United Arab Emirates. There's a German, Rheinmetall operates a training center for infantry in the United Arab Emirates. They used to allow the United Arab Emirates, they had a factory over there where the United Arab Emirates could build their own versions of German weapons. Now, I'm not sure if that factory is still operational. It was that was quite a few years ago that they had that going. But then even just as recently as last month, they signed some agreements and had UAE met with UAE representatives and kind of, you know, brought this alliance closer. So there's every indication Germany knows how the UAE are using their weapons. They know that they're taking these weapons into Yemen, into Libya, into these areas that it is actually illegal to bring the weapons into. But they don't have a problem with that. And they're, in fact, deepening their relationship with the United Arab Emirates. And you see a similar dynamic with Egypt. Like I said, number two on the list. At the moment, at this point in time, Egypt is kind of allied with the anti-Iranian Sunni Arab groups. And so Germany sees an opportunity to support them. And they've had strong arms sales to Egypt, again, going back several years, even selling some very significant weapons to their navy. So they're boosting up their cooperation there as well.
This is one of those stories that we at the Trumpet would look at a lot more closely than people would typically, just because we have such a strong picture of Germany's place in Europe, within Europe, and even alliances within nations in the Middle East in biblical prophecy. Certainly, arms sales give you a fairly good picture of Germany's foreign policy priorities. Maybe you could just put these, what you see on this list of who it's exporting to in its prophetic context.
Absolutely. I mean, this gives us a very kind of, you get a lot of rhetoric in politics, but arms sales are much more solid. And you look at something like Germany's relationship with Hungary, and there's been lots of criticism and back and forth and leaders criticizing each other. But at the end of the day, Hungary's buying a lot of German weapons. They want to bolster their military right now. They have an okay relationship with Russia. They're still nervous about the rise of Russia, and who do they turn for help? Doesn't matter the political backbiting, they turn to Germany. Mm-hmm. And so they've had these very significant arms sales to Hungary. And then the same with the Middle East. You really see a strong indication of German foreign policy in their sales to the Middle East. You know, this kind of trend of Germany selling weapons to the so-called moderate Sunni Arab nations, that's so strong that you know, 5-10 years ago, people started calling this the Merkel Doctrine. You know, this was the way Germany dealt with what was going on in the Middle East, by trying to create these relationships with these Sunni powers. And generally, it was the powers that were opposed to Iran. So they would work with Saudi Arabia. They would work with the United Arab Emirates. They would have a strong relationship with Egypt, with Algeria, where, you know, Algeria is a nation that was held together under a strong leader, but there was a significant danger there of radical Islam. They saw this as a nation that was significant for Europe, that was kind of on the edge, and so they'd funnel weapons to Algeria to try and make sure that they stayed strong. And I think you see pretty much the same strategy in play when it comes to Egypt. Germany sees Egypt as, now they went through that turmoil of the Arab Spring. You've now got a military strongman in charge that has Egypt at least for now in this camp where they're against Iran and they're on Europe's side. Germany sees the risk there. They see the risk for another kind of Arab Spring type moment. They see another risk for Egypt to shift into the opposite camp. And so they're bolstering Egypt as well, in the same way that they were bolstering Algeria. And you look at the past 5 years or so, Algeria was just about the number one receipt of German weapons. And now you're seeing Egypt starting to fill into that plot, that spot, as they're trying to make sure that Egypt stays firm. Now, as you mentioned, the Bible has some very specific prophecies when it comes to the Middle East. And we see those prophecies really starting to be fulfilled already. It talks about the Europe or the Middle East splitting into these same two camps. You have Psalm 83 that describes one alliance of a bunch of Middle Eastern nations that are allied with Assyria or Germany in biblical prophecy. And then you have Daniel 11 that describes the king of the south, and that's referring to radical Islam led by Iran. And there's a different set of nations described in Daniel 11. And you see right now Germany working with just about exactly the same nations identified in Psalm 83. Almost exactly. Right. There are still a few things to fall into place. Daniel 11 tells us that actually Egypt is going to end up in Iran's side.
Yeah.
Germany, obviously, they don't have the benefit of that Bible prophecy. They're working hard to try and make sure Egypt stays in their camp. Ultimately, we know they're not going to be successful. But just this general overall biblical picture of two sides building up this clash that Daniel 11 talks about in great detail, we see that building already. And there's so much detail. It's just amazing how much detail there is in these few verses that you can mine out of these few verses in Daniel 11, written thousands and thousands of years ago. And you can see this clash developing. You can see in those verses the way that Iran has a focus on the Red Sea and on the Mediterranean. And you see that even with these arms sales, the way that German arms are ending up in Yemen on the Red Sea, Libya on the Mediterranean. So you see that clash building. And that's just something that's so important to watch, because as that passage makes clear, all of this is, you know, that's one of the key end time events. It's one of the key events that sets this clash is one of the key events that sets the ball rolling. And so we can see that developing in these arms sales.
Quite fascinating. We'll put a link to an article that Gerald Fleury wrote called The Whirlwind Prophecy in the show notes for today's program, and also one that he wrote called A Mysterious Alliance that goes into some detail about the Psalm 83 German alliance that we're seeing developing. Really interesting stuff. We appreciate that very much, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Now on to the Kings of the East. We've spoken a lot about China's growing economic initiatives around the world. Well, a top official this week admitted these economic activities serve China's military ambitions as well. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is it's an interesting story, because ever since China unveiled its Belt and Road Initiative back in 2013, it has really frequently and adamantly denied that it has any sort of militaristic purpose. It's always insisted this is purely for peaceful economic purposes. You know, China brands the Belt and Road as essentially a resurrection of the ancient Silk Road network. That was the route of, it was a network of trade routes that facilitated the flow of goods and ideas through Asia, Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. And China's new version of it also expands into Latin America and the Caribbean. So China's been working to convince countries in all these regions to accept huge loans so that they can work together to build roads and railway and ports and energy pipelines, things like that. And China has always said to the other countries, it's strictly for trade. You know, you're going to get richer. We're going to get richer. It's a win-win for everybody. It's a good deal. There has always been evidence that China has plenty of military goals tied into the Belt and Road. You can see that in Pakistan and Tajikistan, especially, where foundations are really being laid for Chinese military bases to be built, partly to protect all that infrastructure that China's building. So they want to safeguard their investments there. So serious analysts have long understood that the Belt and Road really does have plenty of military goals tied to it. But despite that, before this week, the official party line from China has been, no, it's strictly economic. It's about peace. So it really caught a lot of analysts off guard when China's top defense official, a man named Wei Fenga, was meeting this week with the top brass, top military officials from various Latin American and Caribbean nations, and also from some Pacific Island nations. And he kind of dispensed with the pretense. He said, quote, "The Chinese military stands ready to deepen mutual trust and consolidate friendship with the militaries of the Caribbean countries and Pacific Island countries." And then he said, "within the framework of the Belt and Road Initiative." So it's kind of a bombshell in some ways, just because after so many years of denying any kind of militaristic goals tied to it, the Chinese are coming right out and saying, yes, we want to work closely with your military. Our military wants to kind of consolidate efforts in a way with yours.
Any thoughts as to why the change? One would presume this wasn't just a slip of the tongue, that there would be some reason why China would be more overt about it.
I think that at this point, China probably understands that the world is well aware of what the Belt and Road is really about. In recent months especially, we've seen quite a lot of backlash toward the Belt and Road Initiative. More and more countries are concerned about the debts that China is kind of encouraging them to rack up, which ends up giving China leverage over them. There have even been concerns about the military nature of it. If you come in here and build a big port, what's to stop you from sending soldiers to kind of safeguard your investment? There have been concerns about a Chinese empire kind of being built around the world. So China knows that the jig is up, in a sense. People understand what this is about. And they may have calculated that for certain nations, especially nations with more and more anti-American sentiments, that the allure of economic advancement is probably less important than the allure of military might and relevance. For a lot of these countries, they even want to see a Chinese empire built around the world because they hate America so much that they're kind of rooting for the alternative. So with some of these nations, China's saying, look, we don't have to pretend to say this is about peace. This is about us rising up. We'll bring you with us. We'll help you come with us, and we'll you know, start to be able to dominate America. We'll end this system where America's the global hegemon. And at this meeting that happened this week, at least one nation, Guyana, really did embrace China's new transparency about the militaristic aspects of the Belt and Road. It was Guyana's army chief said, you know, instead of recoiling away from this, like, whoa, you're talking about military, our military, your military. Instead of that, he said that his nation is eager to deepen military cooperation with China within the Belt and Road framework. So it could be that if that is China's new calculus, that they were accurate. It's hard to know for sure, but going forward, though, especially in dealing with nations where anti-American sentiments are deepening, I think we could see a China that's more inclined to dispense with the pretense, dispense with the niceties, and just say, this is about a global military empire.
We talk about the times of the Gentiles and this shift away from Anglo-American dominance toward other nations, and you would expect that this kind of talk, where they're just more plain spoken about their intent, that we would hear more and more of this kind of language. Still, I guess it's a little bit surprising to hear them coming out with it so overtly. But maybe you could just put this in the context of Bible prophecy in terms of what China and other nations are going to be affecting against the United States, and how that could work against American interests.
Sure, yes. There is that prophecy that Jesus Christ himself spoke about the times of the Gentiles and just kind of a global shift in power away from the Israelitish nations, the U.S. and the U.K. especially, and toward Gentile nations such as Germany and China. And then there's also some very specific prophecies recorded mainly in the books of Isaiah and Ezekiel and Deuteronomy that talk about a mighty anti-American trade bloc that would emerge in our lifetime. And Isaiah 23 specifically names Chittim, which is an ancient name for what has become modern China, as being one of the main nations in this bloc. And then Tyre is also mentioned there as one of the head nations. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has explained in his booklet, Isaiah's End Time Vision, that Tyre represents modern Europe and its kind of commercial focus, its commercial center. And then he's also identified Chittim as China there. And then if you look through these passages, you see that Russia and Japan are also big players in this anti-American trade bloc. And the prophecies show that they will not stop at just excluding the U.S. and some of its allies like the U.K. and Israel from world trade. Instead, they'll actually besiege these countries. And Mr. Fleury even emphasizes in Isaiah's end time vision the role that Latin America will specifically play in this just because of its location. You know, geographically, it's right there next to the U.S. and it borders many of America's key shipping lanes. So many European nations have already established quite a lot of influence in Latin America. And once this alliance forms between China and the Europeans, and also with Russia and Japan and there, all of that Chinese influence that we see building in Latin America, such as we saw this week with Guyana, you know, coming right out and saying, let our military work with yours, all of that will end up translating into even greater European influence just because of the way the alliances there will work. So in this context, it's easy to see, I think, just how significant it is for us to witness this deepening influence that China is now building there in Latin America.
Well, thanks for that. We'll put a link in our show notes for today's program to an article that Gerald Fleury wrote called America is Being Besieged Economically, putting these latest moves by China in their prophetic context. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Finally, to Anglo-America, we've been talking a lot about the deep state in the United States. Well, there's increasing evidence that Britain is facing a similar political force. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, I saw an interview. It actually happened last week. I just actually heard about it this week with the former head of NI6, Sir John Sawyer. He'd gotten on BBC's program and was talking about Britain's upcoming parliamentary elections. They're getting ready to pick a new prime minister, I believe, in a couple of weeks. And Sir John here, he's talking about, he said, Britain's experiencing a nervous breakdown over Brexit. And he said we're having candidates put forward for this election who are not up to the standard that we've become used to. And so this is some pretty direct and thinly veiled criticism of Boris Johnson. He's the Conservative Party official that they're thinking is most likely to get this prime minister spot. He's definitely the front runner at this point. Sir John Sawyer had been pretty critical of him, even in another interview, kind of like tongue-in-cheek, giving credence to some rumors that back when Johnson was foreign minister, MI6 was even withholding classified information from him because Theresa May didn't trust him with it. No, that's something. It was a government leak, like we've become used to in the United States, all sorts of government leaks. Boris Johnson says he doesn't think it's true. Theresa May has not confirmed it. But you've got the government leak and a former head of MI6 getting ready to get on television and talk about this, even though he wasn't in office when it happened. He should have no information about it. But it's very much, that's what this interview caught my attention. It's very much along the trend of what you're seeing in the United States, where you got people like CIA director or former CIA director John Brennan, who's now like literally given a salary by NBC News to accuse President Trump of colluding with the Russians, even though all the people currently in government have done an official investigation, have determined that there's no evidence for that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, another instance where you see Britain following a similar trajectory to that of the United States.
Right. It's very much this trend of former spies and espionage agents getting on television and trying to weigh in on elections. And then this even gets a little more concerning when you kind of put it in the bigger context of the British Secret Service. I mean, they've always had, or at least for the past 100 years, have had very close relationships with America's intelligence agencies. And because of those relationships, there's actually several former MI6 and other intelligence agencies who were even involved in the plot to frame Donald Trump of that Russian collusion. Now, we've talked on this program a ton about Christopher Steele. He's a former MI6 agent whom the Clinton campaign paid to put together a dossier of rumors that they could use to undermine Trump's presidency, get an impeachment campaign rolling against him. And so that name's well known. But even Christopher Steele, he was in contact with MI6, even though he'd already retired from there during this process. There's actually another former MI6 director, Sir Richard Dearlove, who is the one that told Steele that he needed to take this dossier and give it to the U.S. FBI. And then also Richard Hannigan, who is the head of the head of Britain's equivalent of the NSA. And he actually flew to Washington, D.C. during this whole thing to talk with John Brennan about this Russia collusion story. And then apparently when things didn't pan out for him, resigned for quote-unquote personal reasons 3 days after Donald Trump took the oath of office.
So we've this dynamic that we see working in the United States, where we have a president that is very much facing a lot of opposition within his own government, and a lot of people who are doing everything they can to undermine the democratic process that put him into power. You see a similar kind of dynamic playing out within Britain, and for the longest time they were aligned with the European Union. They said, we want to get out, and we see Britain's fortunes aligning more and more with that of the United States. I guess we'll see what happens going forward. Stephen Fleury was talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning, the fact that if Boris Johnson becomes prime minister, he is already trying to bring Britain around to looking to the United States as more of a trade partner, a closer alliance with the United States, and distancing itself from the continent. It'll be really interesting to see what happens here over the next couple of weeks. As you said, they should have a new prime minister very soon. That certainly seems to be the orientation a Boris Johnson administration would take the country. And that is what prophecy says, that the United States and the United Kingdom are, they're going to face a similar fate. They're going down together, as Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied a long time ago, Britain's relationship with the European Union was going to fracture somehow eventually, that was not going to work out the way that those who tried to align it with Europe expected it to, and that they are kind of in bed together, the United States and the United Kingdom, in their fate within biblical prophecy. So if that plays out here over the next couple of weeks, it'll certainly align very closely with what we've been expecting. Very interesting story to watch. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, news about the formation of the world's largest free trade zone, China stealing U.S. military and trade secrets, and American tech giants helping to build China's surveillance state. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This week, the world's largest free trade zone was created in Africa. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
I think it was only last week that I was talking about the world's largest free trade area, and now I'm talking about a new record, depending on how you count it. But the common denominator here on both of those stories, we're talking about Mercosur and Latin America last week, is the European Union.
Yeah.
So this week you had the formation of the African Continental Free Trade Area, or the AfCFTA, of This is made up of 54 African nations. It took, just like Mercosur, 20 years or so to negotiate. It encompasses this time 1.3 billion people. And there's been a fair bit in the news about the formation of this free trade zone. What's often overlooked is the EU's role in creating it. You know, they've been the midwife for this process. They have basically been behind the scenes. They're funding it, giving all the money to have these cords. It got started even in 2007 at the Lisbon summit, where 54 African nations met with EU leaders to create the joint Africa-EU strategy. And if you take just the broad overview of the EU's trade deals with Africa, they've worked quite hard to corral these different African countries into localized trade zones. So for a long time, it was pushing them not into ones that covered all of Africa, but say all of West Africa or all of Southern Africa. And at one point, they even imposed sanctions on Kenya, because Kenya didn't want to, they refused to sign up to a European partnership agreement, and they were trying to push Kenya to come up with, to be part of one of these free trade zones and have Europe involved. So they've been all the way pushing this to happen, and now you've got this European-wide free trade zone. And so you can, and it's modeled in a lot of ways on the European Union, and you can know that they're hoping they're going to have a great degree of influence on this continent-wide trading bloc.
It seems like we've talked more about China's inroads into Africa. Maybe those make splashier headlines, but this is obviously something that's been in the works for a long time. I wonder how much does this kind of pit European interests against those of China?
I don't know. I get the impression that Europe and China have worked quite hard not to cross each other in Africa. Even to when you had the UN's only intervention force rather than peacekeeping force that got involved there in the Congo, two of the biggest contributors to that were China and Germany. So, I mean, to me, it looks like at least they've so far that they've tried to stay out of each other's way. Europe has seemed to mostly focus on northern and western Africa, while China is focused more on southern and eastern. But I guess we'll just have to see how that develops, as both of them really do seem to be expanding their reach and not just being content to stay within those zones anymore.
Any evidence that this is, as we've talked about in relative to other stories, evidence of a new age of colonialism and European conquest in Africa?
There have been quite a few people accusing Europe's trade with Africa of exactly that. Basically, the way that these trade agreements work is generally Africa gets to sell raw materials to Europe cheaply. This is just like the Latin American deal last week. But their industries have to compete on an even footing with European industries, which is very hard. They don't get to kind of protect their own industries and build them up to a point where they can compete. And so there are quite a few critics that are saying that these trade deals lock both these kind of trade deals, free trade deals between Europe and developing countries, lock the developing countries into a colonial arrangement where they're stuck supplying raw materials but can never advance up the value chain of manufacturing. I do take those criticisms with some salt. I think there's some flaws in some of the economic thinking behind those. But I think they do have some, there's some merit in what they say as well.
Well, it is quite eye-popping, I guess, to see these two free trade zones inked with, as you said, with Europe as the common denominator between both of them. Really, the coverage that the Trumpet has had about Latin America and Africa both, when you look at it from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, those areas are mostly notable for their being exploited by the King of the North, the European Empire, and the fact that Europe is making such these massive deals to cement those trade relationships, all within a couple of weeks of one another is quite amazing. I think it'd be a very interesting Trumpet print edition article if we could put together something that showed just how important these regions are for fueling the furnace of European empire that we know is prophesied to dominate the world very soon.
Yes, I think it's also just really interesting the timing of all this. They've been working on these deals for years and years, but it's only now that they're able to get them done, and it's amidst this tide of anti-Americanism where you're seeing a lot of nations coming together with these trade deals that exclude the United States. And so you've seen Europe go around your trade deal with Japan, world's biggest trade area, trade deal with Mexico, trade deal with Mercosur, now the world's biggest trade deal, Africa, the world's biggest trade. You know, it's this coming together of all these different trade deals that all exclude the United States. And it's, you know, this is where you get a whole load of these different prophecies intersect. You've got the rise of Europe and Europe securing those raw materials that it needs to fuel itself. At the same time, there are prophecies that talk about America being cut off from world trade. And Isaiah 23 talks about this mart of nations where the rest of the world gets together. They form their own trading arrangements and they cut off the United States. And in all of this just slew of trade deals, you can really see exactly that kind of mart of nations building. And Europe and China are singled out in that mart of nations, but obviously they're going to have to, you know, include other nations in on that.
Well, very interesting stuff there, Richard. We do have an article that will be published on thetrumpet.com very soon, European Aid Built Africa's Free Trade Zone. Watch for that on the website. And moving on now, among the steps that America is taking to curtail Iran's activities, this week it struck at some Iranian-linked actors within Lebanon. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
The United States did something this week they've never done before. They sanctioned a parliamentarian of the Lebanese government. You've got men sitting there, 120, 110 of them that are there as part of the parliament. And Hezbollah, which is an Iranian ally, makes up part of that governing body. They actually, their coalition has the majority. And so they do hold the rest of Lebanon, even though they're a small group, they hold the rest of Lebanon at ransom to do whatever they would like to accomplish. And the United States this week said, we are going to sanction a couple of those Hezbollah officials. Normally, you wouldn't do this. The rest of the world sees Hezbollah as a political entity and also a military entity. Everybody says the military entity is a terrorist organization, and so they sanction that. But the United States has come along and said, we see no difference between the Hezbollah people that are sitting in seats in the Lebanese parliament and the Hezbollah people that are fighting Israel in Syria and southern Lebanon. And so they put the money where their mouth is this week and said, we are going to start sanctioning these individuals as part of their strategy, not just to weaken Iran, but to really try and rid Lebanon of Hezbollah's influence.
Now, this is interesting. It's happening at the same time that you have Iran in a cash crunch. And we've talked about how this is putting a certain amount of pressure on these Hezbollah operatives within Lebanon. They're not receiving that money from Iran. We also have the prophecy of a division between Lebanon and Iran. Put that in context for us, Brent.
It's really hard for me to see that Hezbollah, the party of God, as they call themselves, are going to give up their relationship with Iran, even if they struggle with finances. You've got the military ring, right, that's fighting in Syria. Well, they're not being paid, and so they are going to struggle. But since we have right now Hezbollah part of the government, they own really critical government portfolios that ensure they control a lot of Lebanese's money. And so they have access to funds inside Lebanon. And I think that's why the United States is really going after the actual parliamentarians, because they want to bust up Hezbollah's hold of the Lebanese government. And the way that they're going to do that, it seems, is start sanctioning not just Hezbollah officials, but also other non-Shiites that are in cahoots with Hezbollah, part of the ruling coalition. Back in March, Secretary of State Pompeo visited Lebanon and said to some of the rulers there, the Speaker of the House, the President, he said, you're not going to be off this sanction list. You better watch out. I want you to start breaking off your relationship with Hezbollah. And the Bible talks about in Psalm 83 that Lebanon is not going to be in a relationship with Iran, not beholden to Iran. Instead, they're going to be allied with other Middle Eastern states that aren't on Iran's side. And so we've been expecting this to take place. And given the success of President Trump's campaign against Iran elsewhere, I think we could give this a shot as actually working out that he will be able to split Hezbollah from Iran inside Lebanon.
Well, we do have an article up on the website that Brent has written. U.S. hits back at Iran in Lebanon. You can go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Chinese agents have been busy, and the United States is their target for this story. We'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a trial has just concluded in Southern California, and the jury found an adjunct professor at UCLA, a Chinese-American man named Yi Qisha, guilty of stealing classified information about missile guidance chip technology. And he sent this information back to China. He was able to hack into the systems of a company that was making these advanced integrated circuits for U.S. military missiles. And then he sent it to a Chinese firm called Chengdu Gasstone. He was found guilty. He could face up to 219 years in prison for this theft. And then there were actually two other stories this week that are somewhat similar. There was a Chinese software engineer indicted on charges of stealing American trade secrets from an unnamed U.S. company that he worked for. He was found guilty of 9 counts of theft of electronic files. He's actually at large right now, possibly back in China, so it's hard to say if he'll face any punishment. And then the third case from this week was a former employee of Tesla Motors, and he was a Chinese national. He admitted that he stole proprietary information about Tesla's autopilot source code. So he uploaded it and he gave it to a Chinese vehicle manufacturer. And that's, it's information that Tesla spent millions to develop, and now China has that for free. So these three stories have a similar theme. It's people with their loyalty to China stealing from the U.S. and giving that very valuable information to China.
This is part of a trend that's been going on for years.
It is, yes. Experts say that China's intellectual property theft costs the United States somewhere between $225 billion and $600 billion every year. So it's just a stunning amount of theft. And more analysts are coming to see, just how serious this ongoing theft by the Chinese is. But there's something a lot more momentous about this that very few experts recognize, and that is that it was actually foretold specifically in Bible scriptures written thousands of years ago. There's a chapter there, Deuteronomy 28, which talks about some ways that God would bless Israel if they obeyed him and ways that he would curse Israel if they rejected him. And Israel there refers mainly to the United States and Britain, which our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, thoroughly explains. And in one of these specific curses, in verse 33, it says, if Israel rejected God, the fruit of your land and the fruit of all your labors would be stolen and consumed by an outside power. So this is, it's exactly what's happening. Right now we see America rejecting God more and more. As a result, God is allowing the fruits of U.S. labor, car technology, weapons technology, and much more to be stolen and consumed by a foreign power, exactly as he warned in this prophecy. But the prophecy doesn't stop there. The same Bible that accurately foretold modern America having its fruits and its labors devoured by an enemy nation, it also says that this thievery will not be allowed to go on indefinitely. There's a really inspiring chapter in Isaiah 65, and verses 21 through 23 talk about a time in the future when earth will be under God's government instead of under man's government. And it clearly says that systematic theft, like the type that we see China engaging in today, will be a thing of the past. So it's a very inspiring picture of the future, and we go into more detail about that in our article, China Steals U.S. Trade Secrets and Fulfills Bible Prophecy.
All right, we'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thanks very much for that, Jeremiah. China has the most authoritarian and active surveillance state in the world, And it turns out that U.S. tech companies are helping to build it. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, I've focused quite a bit on U.S. tech companies recently, especially Google. We had a story on this program not long ago about Google's efforts to build new machine learning algorithms that can prioritize liberal content and censor conservative content in the United States, even with one high-ranking Google executive saying that they were doing this on purpose to be able to influence U.S. elections. There's also abundance of evidence, some new information even coming out this week, that a foundation called the Open Power Foundation, it's a nonprofit led between by Google and IBM, has actually partnered with a Chinese company to do some of the same things in China and even a few steps beyond that. This the Chinese company is Septian, and like I said, they've partnered with Google and IBM to come up with a program they call Aegis, which is, according to a Septian employee who sent some documents to The Intercept, this Aegis program gives the Chinese government a full view of the virtual world. They can see connections to everyone, including location information for everyone in the country. It collects email records, phone records, text records, cell phone locations, web browser histories. And then is even able to, I'm not actually sure how they do this, but according to this employee, block certain information on the internet from being visited. So a pretty advanced program that's allowing China to spy on and track the citizens of its country and also censor what information they can see online. And obviously that's horrible if you're Chinese. It's also concerning that the same California-based tech companies that just admitted 2 weeks ago that they're working on machine learning algorithms to influence U.S. politics has this kind of technology, where they're saying it's like we actually have the ability to track every cell phone in the country, track everyone's browsing history, collect everyone's phone records, and block web content from the internet, or at least on our servers completely. Yeah, so, and I mean, I kind of commented on this trend already in an article I wrote a couple weeks ago on the reason Google is working against President Trump. And that brings to light some scriptures in Daniel 8 about truth being cast to the ground in the end time. Particularly about like an Antiochus type figure who cast this truth to the ground, and there's a spiritual element behind him. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, explains this all in detail in his book, America Under Attack. He also has a Key of David program entitled Daniel 8:12, A Dual Prophecy, talking about this prophecy about truth being cast to the ground in the United States. Specifically linking the Obama administration as using a lot of these powers from Silicon Valley, you know, the PRISM program and the NSA spying scandal as part of that process of casting truth to the ground. And now you're seeing so many like former Obama agents even working for these same Silicon Valley companies that are making these algorithms to censor what information Americans can see, to censor information the Chinese can see, and make sure that the, I guess, quote-unquote, truth people all over the world hear is the truth they want them to hear.
Mm. Pretty stunning. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today, including America Under Attack, which Andrew just mentioned. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Edward Young. Affliction is the good man's shining time. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.